This is Wells Tech, a show that explores the intersection of technology and ministry. Wells Tech is a part of the Streams Media Network sponsored by Wells, the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. Your show hosts are Martin Spriggs and Sally Draper. Join the conversation at wellstech.wells.net. Wells Tech is on the air. This is episode 336, recorded on Tuesday, April 8th, 2014. My name is Martin Spriggs.
And I'm Sally Draper, and I'm afraid you have a new name this week, Martin. We need to send some congratulations your way.
I have a new name in the family, yes. My first grandchild was born on Sunday evening at 8:35, 7 pounds, 8 ounces, 20.5 inches.
Wow, how exciting, and major congratulations to you and all of your family, your lovely daughter as well.
Yeah, Alicia and Thomas, my oldest, and her husband, who live in southern Indiana, had their first child. Everybody's doing great, including little Murray, who has more hair than I do.
He's a cutie. I got to see a picture, and I know you must be really proud to be a grandpa.
We saw him via, I think we had to use FaceTime. Hangouts was not cooperating last night, so we saw him for the first time, and we're going to go down there this weekend to see him in person. So
very
I think Debbie's
good.
Bags were packed long ago for this group, so. She's very happy to have her first grandson as well.
I can only imagine. My three boys say they'll never get married or have kids, so we'll see.
Well, that's too bad, because it's the economic burden for you having three boys is not nearly as great as if you had three girls. So
yeah.
We've encouraged our girls to elope, and the first one didn't take the hint, and hopefully the second one will. Anyway, we have other things to talk about, and in fact, we have a jam-packed show today, and that is because the topic is one that probably is of interest to almost everybody who's on the net, either as a user or as a webmaster, somebody who needs to collect information, and that's using forms. And we're really narrowing our conversation today, Sally, down to one specific technology, although there's a lot of different variations of that, and that's using our old friend Google Forms. And I know you put a lot of legwork into this, and you being a Google certified something or other should be front and center for this conversation.
According to Google, I'm a qualified individual. I don't know what that means exactly, but I do love Google Forms, and you're right. There are a lot of forms tools out there. We could probably, you know, name a couple. WooFoo and JotForm are very, very popular forms tools. You can work with them for free. You can also pay for more privileges with both of those tools. Google Forms, on the other hand, is completely free. And maybe some people might say not quite as robust. Certainly, Google Forms are not designed for any kind of e-commerce monetary collection. You shouldn't collect any private data over Google Forms. That's just kind of a given with Google Forms. It's more of a simplistic tool than that. Mm-hmm. But some of the things that I'll demonstrate today do open up a lot more capabilities with Google Forms, especially for church and school office use. I'll just share my screen once more, because I do want to show you just a quick peek. Those of you that aren't able to see the screen or listening to the audio version, the behind the scenes is really straightforward. As you build these different types of fields, you can just select what type of item you want to add to your form, and type out a question, include some help text if you want some helpful text to go along with it, click done, and just like that, you've created a form. There's links in the behind the scenes form creation tool to view the live form and share the link. And Google actually also automatically feeds all the data that's collected by the form into a spreadsheet. So that's probably really good advice, Martin, is that as you're designing forms, maybe you're thinking in terms of spreadsheets and how the form data is going to be able to be viewed and sorted and manipulated in a spreadsheet type view, because that's
critical. You almost have to start from the back to the front, because the form is really just a conduit, a channel through which you're gathering information. The information is the important part, so you want it in a form or format that is going to be useful for you, and it's typically going to be, you know, many rows, and it could be many responses that you're going to have to deal with. So you don't want to have to create more work for yourself by not thinking through what you're going to get. So obviously test, test, test. You know, create a form, submit it, see if that's the kind of data format that's going to work best in your situation. So, and that's easy to do. And that's the way Google Forms works. There's always a form, and there's always a spreadsheet, and the two work together.
That's right. One more capability that I just want to make mention of is that Google will allow you to email your forms to Gmail recipients. So the form will embed nicely in an email, and they can actually submit the form right there from their email receipt of the form. This works well if you're a Google app, school, or organization, because obviously everyone then would be on Gmail. But if you try to email the forms to non-Gmail addresses, it doesn't behave as well. So just keep that in mind and use that as a warning. Excuse me. All right. Next up, I wanted to show you an example of branching. And by branching, I mean you can send people to different pages of your form depending on how they respond to multiple choice questions.
Kind of a conditional response. So if they respond one way, you can go this line of questioning. If they go another, you can present something else.
Exactly.
Very powerful. So
I do have an example here where I asked, you know, are you a Mac or a PC? And the three radio button options are Mac, PC, and Linux. So if you don't fit either, you could perhaps select Linux, and then you would press continue, and it brings up a question specific to those who selected Linux. What version of Linux do you use? In contrast, if you were to select PC, it would ask you what brand of PC do you use or whatever. So just a quick example of a branching form, and I did want to demonstrate how that is done.
And that's so just a basic feature within Google Forms, correct?
Yeah, it's just not super obvious that it's there.
Okay.
So I'll just show a quick demo. I set up one, and you guys that are watching can see that I have like a multiple choice question. What type of service did you participate in? This maybe would be a teen survey where you've challenged the teens to get involved in some type of service in your church. And so I have Sunday school helper or usher as my two multiple choice options. Then I did a page break, and I built a separate page for Sunday school helper with some specific questions about those duties, and another page break and built a specific page for usher duties. So after I've built the original question and the two pages that I want to route to, I need to go back and edit my multiple choice questions. And at that point, you're going to have an option that says go to page based on answer. So you need to check that box, and then you tell it which page you want to go to. So
that's only pulling up whatever page breaks you've inserted.
Exactly. So you have to build all that in advance and then come back and do the edit to do this mapping, basically. So if they choose Sunday School Helper, I'm going to send them to that Sunday School Helper page. If they choose Usher, I'm going to send them to the Usher page. And then I need to click Done. And then there's one more little nuance, and that is I don't want them to go linear through this entire form. If they choose Sunday School Helper, I want them to be done after they answer the Sunday School Helper page. So instead of continuing to the Usher page, I'm going to tell them to give the option to submit the form. And again, on the Usher page, it's the last page, so that should happen. But I'll just specify that when they're done with that page, they submit the form.
Or you could take them to another page break after that.
Exactly. Continue.
Right.
Continue, right. You can get real complex with this, you know, kind of like a choose your own adventure kind of effect.
Can you move the pages around once you've created these page breaks? So if you wanted to change the order or something?
Yeah, absolutely. You just drag and drop, and they'll move around wherever you want them to be. Mm-hmm. Of course, when I did that, I disconnected the question from the page. So I need to drag that page break to the correct place, which would be right here.
And it's saving as you go along. There is no save button within Google. It's automatically saving it as you make changes, correct?
That's correct. So now I'm going to go to the View the Live form. And now on the first page, I just have them asking Sunday School Helper or Usher. And depending on which one I select, it takes me to either the Usher page with the Submit button, or if I select Sunday School Helper, it takes me to the Sunday School Helper page with a Submit button. Right. So pretty simple to do, but you need those components. You need a multiple choice question, and you need the pages you want to route it to. And then you go back and edit that multiple choice question to set it all up and make the magic work. All right. I did want to demonstrate one more thing while I'm in this edit mode of this team form, and that's how to add a password to a form. One thing about Google Forms is the live form is public on the web, and there's no security settings around that. That's just the way it is. It's public on the web. And so what you can do to kind of get around that is add an item. I'm going to add it on this first page. And I'm just going to say password. You would write out a nice question or whatever. It's going to be a text item, but I'm going to use the advanced settings to do data validation. And I'm going to say that it's a text string that contains, and I give it the phrase that I want it to contain. Maybe it's the word password. Whatever you want to set as your password. And you can put some error text.
Don't use password.
Yeah, don't use that. That's probably the most common one. And again, you'd want to do this. I'm going to make it my first question on my form. And then I'm going to put a page break after that. So you'd want to do this on a page by itself. And I'll just call it page one. Real creative here. So I'm going to put that page break after the password question. And now when I view the live form, what comes up is, what's the password? And I have to type that in. I think I can tell it to mask that as well. But without typing it, if I were to type it in correctly, it wouldn't let me go on to the rest of the form. So,
right. So it's kind of a hack around
exactly
what Google has not provided by default. And I would think that at some point they're going to be able to provide that. A lot of the other forms tools do that kind of thing, so I would suspect that that's on their radar. But this is a pretty easy way to do it, just through a simple validation.
Okay. Next up, I just want to give you a word of caution, and that is oftentimes we'll have questions along the lines of check all that apply, and we'll give people a big long list, or check your top three choices, or whatever it may be. We're asking for multiple things to be input on that one checkbox question. We give them a long list of options. And unfortunately, Google Forms doesn't handle that data really well. What ends up happening in your spreadsheet, if you're looking on my screen, you can see that I did fill out the form once, and all the things I checked came in one cell of my spreadsheet. And that, yeah, you can't sort on that. You can't do a whole lot with that. It's really a pain to work with data where it's all just clumped. I think it has some comma delimiters and stuff, but it really doesn't parse it out into separate columns and allow you to sort. So what I want to demonstrate for you is an alternate way to do checkbox questions. And what I did was I did separate questions for each individual checkbox. So my first question has the question text, what are areas of technology and ministry you'd like help with? And then I just put one response in that question. And then I did separate questions with no question text, just the response, the checkbox information. Let me show you what that looks like. Since there's no question, the options are spaced out a little bit. But
that's tolerable.
Yeah, it's easier to read that way even. And so that's okay. And actually, your spreadsheet then parses out all of the responses into individual columns, which you can sort on and do various manipulations.
And if they don't respond, it just remains blank.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a much better solution, just kind of learn from my mistakes kind of thing, that Google Forms doesn't handle multiple checkboxes real well on the spreadsheet side.
Right.
All
Sally,
right.
Can you get any more tabs open there?
I'm working on it. Give me time. I do want to show you a little bit. We've looked at the spreadsheet side of things, but here's an example form where I collected some recital sign-up information.
Oh,
and
good.
in the responses, I picked this one because it has 27 responses, you can see that spreadsheet view really easily, and you can manipulate the spreadsheet and things like that. We're pretty much all aware of that, but I also want to point out to you that in the form management tools, there's something that says summary of responses, and it brings up kind of a graphical view of the data that was collected. So if you had, yes, no type questions or whatever, you might get a pie graph of it. You can't control how it displays it. You get what you get. So this one, I was asking them whether they wanted to come at two different time slots, and I got a pie chart that indicated which time slot they selected. I asked them if they needed piano accompaniment for their violin recital piece, and I got a pie chart that represented the responses of that. So it's just another view, and sometimes it's nice and quick and easy to use that more graphical, summarized view, and they kind of tuck it away. Again, it's in the form builder tool under the responses menu, and it says summary of responses.
So just that might be a good tool that a math teacher would use, for their class, maybe middle graders or whatever, to build these. And when they're talking about data gathering and statistics and those kinds of things, mm-hmm. Build some questions that stretch the or exercise those math skills. So
absolutely. All right. Let's see what's next up. I did want to show you just a couple of real-life examples of forms that hopefully would be useful in your ministry settings. The first one I have for an example is another one of those branching forms. So here's one that has real meaning, where you would use this as a teacher at the end of the day when you're having the students check in and document the work that they've done in class that day. So they would put their name and the date, and then they could choose between whether they did reading, working on writing, word work, or fluency. And depending on which choice, then they would get that second page. And I'll just quick put in some information so I can navigate to the second page of the form. In this case, I chose read to self, so then I have to put in the title of the book that I was reading. Maybe you'd ask them how many pages they read or whatever. So this is an example of one of those branching forms. End of day check-in, they don't have to come to you to check-in. They use their Chromebooks or whatever to document the work that they did in class for that day.
So I don't know if you know the answer to this, but is there a way to automatically insert the username, the logged in user, if you're using it like in a Google Apps setting, as opposed to them typing in their name?
And the answer to that is absolutely yes, if you are in a Google Apps setting. And unfortunately, this one isn't on my Google Apps account. I'll have to find an example to show that. But in a Google Apps setting, up here at the top where it says form setting, it would say automatically collect their email address, I believe.
Okay. In the example you just provided, you wouldn't need to ask for name.
Absolutely.
You could pre-populate that, then the students couldn't kind of work around the system, enter a classmate's name, and you'll have fun with it that way.
That's true. Very true. You're always thinking, Martin. Good answer. Here's an example of a page on a Google site where they actually embedded the form. That's another capability with forms. You can get embed code and put them on the website. And so in this example, they have kind of a two-column display, and in one column they embedded YouTube videos that they wanted the students to watch. And then on the other column, they have the
assessment. Awesome.
Yeah, the assessment right there next to the video. So watch the video, take the test right next to it. So,
and it would submit it just like a regular form.
Yep.
Great idea.
All right. Here's an example of a form, and again, I'll have links to these because sometimes it's just harder to think about how you can use them. This is a start of the year parent survey. So a lot of times when school year starts, we ask the kids about their summer or whatever. There's certain things we go through at the beginning of a school year to kind of get it kicked off. I thought this survey was excellent, where you actually ask the parents for their feedback, how they'd like to volunteer, how well does their child read, what are your hopes and dreams for your child this year in school. So just another example of something practical that you can use Google Forms for.
Very nice.
Yep. Let's see what's next. This one is the jackpot one. This is from our friend Rob Gunther. He actually heard that we were talking about forms today and sent in this excellent example of the use of a form for staff development, basically. So this is called their ministry development plan. They use something similar to this up at Grace in Kenai, Alaska, where Pastor Rob Gunther serves. And basically, they use forms to do kind of a self-evaluation, to write down all the ways that they're serving in their congregation, at a district or synod level, any community service they do, to kind of review their professional growth activities from the past year, so a place to document any conferences or whatever that they've attended, and also to kind of evaluate, was it worth their time and what they learned from the experience, so kind of a reflection type activity. And then the really neat page is for goal setting, and there's some verbiage at the top that talks about having SMART goals, goals that are strategic and measurable and attainable, etc. And then it goes through the process of listing what your spiritual growth goals may be, your personal and family goals, your professional growth goals, perhaps classroom instruction goals, technology and ministry goals, department, school, or church-wide goals. So a place to gather all that information. And then Pastor Gunther actually shared this with us as an example of how he uses an add-in tool called Autocrat. We'll have a link in the show notes where it formats that information and emails it to the person. And he actually sets it up with follow-up then to email on a regular basis to remind them of their goals for the year and allow them the chance to reflect on those maybe on a quarterly basis or whatever. So I thought it was an excellent use, and I wanted to make sure there was an example here that other churches and schools could make use of as well.
Beautiful. Yeah, thank you, Rob, for being willing to share that. That's a great use of a number of technologies, not just forms, but some of those reminder tools that he's mentioned before as well to help everybody understand that, hey, this is not a dead document. This is something that needs to be paid attention to going forward. So excellent.
Definitely.
Excellent, excellent.
I'll have an example again in the show notes to a form for collecting flower donations, for instance. That's one thing that many congregations do is allow people to donate flowers for the altar to beautify the worship service. And so this form is set up to gather the information, the donation date, whether it's given in honor or in memory of someone, and then any special designation for the flower offering. And one thing I thought of was you could use Autocrat again to email the results of the form, maybe formatted already for copying and pasting into bulletin or newsletter announcements. So set up the text around those kind of announcements and have this form just kind of plug in and merge into that and email that so it's ready to go into the bulletin or newsletter.
Good. Apparently Rob is watching live and he makes a comment. He says, I can't take any credit for the plan. That's all from Greg Schmill from Commission on Lutheran Schools. So kudos to Greg. And sayonara to Greg. Greg has taken a call and he's leaving his position with the Synod as the school's administrator. He's I forget the name of the organization that he is going to, but he'll be continuing to assist schools as far as strategic planning and consulting practice. So
excellent. Martin, I alluded to Pastor Gunther. I should turn off my screen share. Let's see if I can do that and be a real person again. I alluded to Pastor Gunther sharing information about Autocrat in particular, and I wanted to just kind of read a little bit from the email that he sent that describes how he does soccer camp, VBS, Christmas for Kids, those types of registrations. I think that's something that every congregation is involved in gathering information for those, and I think he's kind of got it down to a science. So let me just share with you how he's doing that. He says he has an online form that he uses for registration. The parents fill it out, and the data is dumped into a spreadsheet. And then Autocrat, this add-in tool, takes the data, merges it into a Google Doc, and saves it on Google Drive in a folder, wherever he designates, basically. It also emails whom he, the person he designates. In case, in this particular case, he gets notified via email, and the email address from the form is used. So the person that registered the child for the event.
Kind of a confirmation email, right?
Right. He actually used to email it to his printer as well. So his printer on his network had its own email address. He would email the form there, and it would print. And for some reason, he's decided he has too much paper in his life, and that was a bit of overkill.
He's probably listened to this podcast, I think.
Yeah, at least half of it, anyway. So too much paper, he's not going to worry about the paper copy anymore, but have it electronically in his Google Drive. He says the whole thing used to be completely automated and would merge upon form submission. Right now, Google just rolled out this add-in capability, and the Autocrat add-in doesn't have all the functionality that the Autocrat script had. And so there's kind of a in-between stage. You can still use the script if you want that functionality, and hopefully they're going to beef up the add-on over time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that brings up a good question. Some of these events, you want to receive payment. Google Forms out of the box does not allow or do that, correct?
That's correct. That's where you might jump to a tool like JotForm or WooFoo that you could do payments with, but those are going to be a little bit more complex to set up. You can also use kind of a generic donation type thing on your website through PayPal. We've looked at doing that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And PayPal integrates fairly easily on your website as well, or you can have them pay when they show up to drop their kit off. You know, I mean, you can do it a lot of different ways. But if you want online payment, Google Forms is not going to be the tool to do that.
It's not an end-to-end solution there, right?
Correct. Okay. So, Martin, you were aware of another script that you were going to share
with
us?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the questions that Forms users would sometimes ask would be, can I ask users to upload content, you know, that would be attached to the form? So a teacher might want to receive an assignment, or there may be documents that need to be filled out and then uploaded as a separate attachment. So.
Or maybe images if you're doing some kind of photos. Yep. Contest or whatever.
Or images. And there is a tool. There's probably more than one. The one that that I found and found useful is something called Form Plus. It's at formpl.us. And the way it works is it, like a lot of the add-ins for Google, it requests permission from your Google account to sync with it or to talk to it, to use what's called the API. And so it says, hey, I'm going to go create a folder. So if you look at my Google Drive, it's created a folder called Form Plus, and that's where it's going to put some code. It's going to put that familiar spreadsheet. It's going to put a form file that it reads, and it's going to create a folder that will receive the files that get uploaded. So it separates things out nicely. So when you're in the form, the form builder is very simple. So this is something that you wouldn't actually build in Google Forms, but it would be kind of an add-in. So you have a forms builder here, and you drag and drop. So I'm going to, for just simplicity's sake, just add a quick text input, and then you can say what that text input should be labeled. So maybe it's first name or last name or whatever, whether it's a required field. It's got some of the similar things. But over here under File Upload, it's just got one option, and you can drag that File Upload feature or module right onto the page, and it has a Choose File button. So if I were to create this then or to publish this and somebody were to go to this form and they'd have to go to a specific URL, they would come to this form, they'd enter their name, they'd be able to choose a file from their local hard drive, attach it, and hit submit. And then what it would do is it would add all that stuff into your Google Drive account. So first of all, you would see that in your spreadsheet, you'll see their notation. So if I open up the spreadsheet, I did a test here, and it'll note that there was a file that was uploaded and give you a link to it. But then you can look into your Google Drive subfolder and find the document that they uploaded. So they can upload almost anything. And I'm not sure if there is any file upload limit. you're certainly limited by the file size of Google Drive that Google Drive allows, but that's pretty big. There may be some other limitation. You wouldn't want to ask them to upload real large files. But this is a free tool, and I think created specifically to work with Google Drive. They do have some templates here. You have a contact form, a feedback form, submit your resume, an assignment submission form that kind of pre-populates these fields for you. And kind of makes it easy for you to kind of get started with this. So that's one solution that might work well if you're looking to upload files into your Google Drive.
All kinds of options out there. So if we haven't covered it yet, I will mention there's other scripts and things. We've actually talked about a few recently on the show, that how you can schedule Google Forms and limit submissions and get Google Forms to send the data that was collected in an email. And there's one called Flubaroo. They all have these funky names. Flubaroo will actually grade your forms for you. So you fill out the form with the correct answers to your multiple choice test, and it'll compare and give your students a grade based on that. So there's many, many more things than we're able to cover in today's podcast and do it justice. But I do think that forms are an excellent tool, something to put in your tool belt and make use of for your church and school ministry.
Yeah. So all that and more on the show notes page, wellstech.wells.net, if you're interested. If you have other resources that we haven't covered or carried there on the show notes page, please share those with us. I know that those of you that are in the trenches probably have come up with questions and answers that we haven't thought of or looked for. So please share those so that everybody else can benefit as well. So let's move along. We do have a couple of categories here where we ask our listeners, viewers, slash audience to contribute to the show, not just for in our community feedback section, but in our on a resources or review section. So we have this thing called ministry resources. So if you find something that might be useful in a ministry context, whether it's software, hardware, website, whatever, please submit that. If you do so, you would first of all, we'd share that on the show, but you'd also be entered to win an Apple TV. This week, our next category, we do have a listener review. And Jason Winjet, who we saw at the Unconference in New Ulm, I believe, right?
That's correct.
And he decided to do a review, a listener review, of something called Creately. .com, a Visio-like cloud-based tool, and we're going to play that now. It's a little 5-minute video where he talks through his review of a tool that I think he finds pretty valuable, and by doing so, Jason is going to be entered to win a Nexus 7 tablet that we would have waiting for a lucky winner for this category. So let me see if I can actually get this going here.
Hi, this is Jason Winjet with Faith Lutheran Church in River Falls, Wisconsin, and I wanted to share with the Wells Tech community Creately.com, a quick review, a quick demonstration. Creately is similar to Visio. If you're familiar with the various things you can do with Visio, Creately is very similar to that. It is a Flash-based application, so it runs on the web. It is kind of Google Docs-like and has a feel of Google Drive to it. But Creately allows you to create 50 different types of diagrams, and it does so with what they call easy-to-draw and smart-shape connectors. So if you have these shapes you drop out, it allows you with these contextual menus to make things very easy to pull together. These toolbars that pop up with the various components are very easy, and this is a collaboration tool primarily, so you can have groups of people working with this, and you want it to be easy to do that, and Creately for the most part is, but it does allow you to create some very nice types of things as you go through them. Part of it, because of the smart shapes, it forces you to utilize certain components so that it makes things work together better, so diagramming isn't so cumbersome as a group. It allows you to pull those things together. So there are a variety, as I said, 50 different types is what they say, from flow charting to organizational charts, interactive maps and the wireframes and mind maps and those types of things. So there's all these different types that you can work with. And some good examples, you know, with the organizational charts in a school, perhaps, or flow charts that you want to process map something, you can do that very easily with it. Various types of data and the mind maps and those types of diagrams are very easy to work with. They do compare themselves to Visio. I don't know if I necessarily completely agree. I would say that Visio is that working with a pen and a pencil, where Creately it's more like a whiteboard and a whiteboard marker as far as the quality you get from them. Being Flash, Creately is slow to load, just like Google Docs and Sheets are. Not very snappy when you get into it. But it does allow you to get that creative component going just simply by sharing a link. Here's my equivalent of Google Drive is this home space where you can see your documents, work with them. You can have folders. So I was working with St. John's Popple Creek on an audio flow design for their new church. And this was something that I could work with, send out as a PDF. I could also just send out the link. If I was collaborating with someone, they could actually make changes on it, and I can send it to, in this case, send it to the vendor, and they're able to give a quote based on what I was envisioning and diagramming out. So here I have a blank space, so I can just put together a very quick flow here to go from start and then into to finish. So I can have just choose my quick connector here. And I can put it, and I'll connect my connector on either side, and it will connect that really quick. So I can make that my green start, and then I can make that my red stop. My process needs to go in the right direction, so I'll just click on that, and let's choose that arrow. And we'll click on that and just type in stop. I'll click on that and type go. And there's my first process. So very easy to do that. Under the properties here, I have a basic description. I have a link to the view diagram, a link to edit diagram, so people could come in here and make changes very easily. Creately does have a free version, so you can give it a try. You have a public diagram, though, so anyone in the share space can see your diagrams, which is the reason why I went to the $49 one, is that I could create private ones, and then I could control the sharing. The other thing is that my projects, too, I have an unlimited number of projects, and that's those folders. So all in all, Creately is a good application. Do enjoy using it, working with groups of people. Having that cloud storage as opposed to saving like a Visio diagram, making it a PDF, sending it off. If you're working in a WebEx or a Google Hangout or those some type of thing, you can work interactively. There is a 50% discount for education, so if it's something that you're interested in, you'll want to contact them to get that discount code. And something I've not used, but they do have the Creately desktop, and perhaps that's something that might address some of the lag issues of just working in a Flash environment. So if it's something that you want to check out, and you do, please let me know. I'd like to hear how it worked out for you. They do have a one-time fee for that, and it does include that online personal plan in the first year. So it's not as difficult getting into it price-wise as Visio is. So I hope you enjoyed this review of Creately.com. Good luck.
Great job, Jason. A star is born, huh?
That was a nice review. Very professionally done. Good illustration, you know, good demonstration techniques. Seems to me like Creately is kind of a cross between kind of a mind mapping tool, Visio, you know, some of those other diagramming tools, you know, in a, you know, kind of a nice looking package. So, and fairly reasonable. I think he said $49 a year, right?
Correct.
Yeah, that's not bad.
Not bad. Yep. Just one plug for our friends at TechSmith. Jason informed us that at Wells Tech Camp, he won a copy of Snagit, and he used Snagit to create that screencast. So thank you, TechSmith, for those donations.
Very cool. And thank you, Jason, for your contribution. You'll be entered to win an Nexus 7 tablet, which we will be drawing for at the end of May. So time is running out. You want to get in on actually a fairly short list at this point. Your chances are good. Submit a listener review just like Jason did. It doesn't have to necessarily be a YouTube video, something like that. It can be just a blog post, something that helps people review or rate what you're looking at, and that would be great. Sally, we're running long already here. let's do our tips of the week. My tip of the week, actually I don't have a screenshot for this, but it is simply a recommendation to pick your ecosystem carefully. And what I mean by that is nobody just has a computer, very few people just have a computer these days, so they're no longer just a PC or a Mac. They sometimes will have a tablet, they may have a phone, all of which are married to some kind of ecosystem. There's app stores, there's different tools. Where these ecosystems become kind of interesting and even more important is with your media files. So your videos, your audio files, your pictures. And they all have different ways of providing those to you. So if you, for instance, use something like iTunes, so you rent your movies on iTunes or you buy music on iTunes, that has some things that go along with that as far as where you can enjoy that. So let's say you have an iPhone, and that's how you prefer to listen to your music. You're okay because on a PC, if you have a PC, you can load iTunes, but that's not always the case. So I did a quick, just kind of a back of the napkin, and you'll appreciate this, Sally. You know, a little post-it note, you know,
good
a little
job,
chart. That was just the easiest way to do it.
Yeah. Paper does come
writing.
In handy.
Yeah, sometimes. So I took kind of the basic players in, let's say, the music space and the video space and the photo space and kind of did a comparison. iOS, Android, or Microsoft, you know, the Microsoft phone platform or the Windows platform. And so Xbox Music, if that's something that you're into, that works across all three platforms, which is great. Google Music, the same. Google Play Music, the same way. iTunes, as you might expect, just
iOS.
One place.
Yep.
You can't get it on Android. You can't get it on a Windows phone. You can get it on a computer. Same kind of story with video, Google Play Video. That's actually what I use if I'm renting movies and such. iOS is good. Android is good. Not so good on on Microsoft. If you rent on iTunes Video, you're stuck with iOS, of course. Xbox Video, same kind of deal. You're stuck with Windows. Amazon, if you do any Amazon Instant Video stuff, mm-hmm. iOS and Android, but not Microsoft or Windows Phone. And then finally, pictures, iPhoto, if that's the way you choose to do your photos, and iCloud, you guessed it. You know, you're stuck with whatever Apple's going to provide for you. But if you store them on Google, Google Drive, then you can get at them from any platform, same with OneDrive and some of the other places. So the advice here is if you're going to kind of have a mixed environment where you have iOS or Android or Windows, just make sure that you're looking at your platform from that perspective too, because you really don't want to have, you know, you don't want to have to rent or you'll have media in all these different places and only be able to get to them from certain devices. So, and you don't want to lock yourself into a device. That's what they want you to do. So they say, well, you're in iTunes, therefore you can never leave the Apple camp. So just a word of caution.
Excellent, Martin. I have an assignment for you. I need you to get out that fancy smartphone of yours and take a picture of that piece of paper and email it to me. I'd love to see it and put it in the show notes.
You know, I'd have to clean it up a little bit because
okay.
I can't even read my own writing. That's part of my problem.
So. Okay. That's why you're against paper. You know, I was thinking about my digital life since mm-hmm. probably about the year 2000 or so. Digital images, no more print, that kind of thing. And what it would be like if it went all the way back to the year I was born in 1965. You know, that 65 to 2000, that was a chunk of time where I have stacks of print images. So, you know, fast forward into the future, and this is our whole lifetime of images, and all of a sudden they're here, there, and everywhere, and not accessible and lost in the cloud, potentially, if you aren't, you know, being wise about how you're storing these things.
I can't probably even count the number of hours I've spent moving some of those assets around, you know, where a service is going out of business, or you were afraid they were and you wanted to move, or something was cheaper, or they started charging, you know, those kinds of things. So these kind, you shouldn't make these kinds of decisions lightly, you know, as mm-hmm. far as where you're storing stuff, maybe where you're buying stuff, as, you know, this subscription thing, or you're buying a movie that you always want to be able to watch, or have your grandkids watch, or whatever. It's important to kind of think about that as far as long-term versus, well, I can get to it today, but can I get to it tomorrow?
And, you know, to apply that to churches and schools, church and school archives.
Yep.
You know, we do have those rusty, dusty scrapbooks and things from yesteryear, but nowadays we're just relying on digital, and are we going to lose our history because it hasn't been stored properly or whatever?
Yep. So. We're in a proprietary format that's no longer available. Yep, stuff to think about. So consider your ecosystem.
Thank you, sir.
Sally, what's your tip?
Mine's a lot shorter. It has to do with my trusty, dusty smartphone and tablet. And what I want to tell you is that for your own security, I would encourage you to clean your screen. And I have my son, Luke Draper, to thank for this tip, because he picked up my phone yesterday and he said, Mom, I bet your passcode has the numbers 4, 2, 7, 9, and 0 in it. And I was like, Luke, he got 3 of the 5 numbers, whatever they were, correct. And that was because my fingerprints were on the screen from touching the passcode. So I never thought of that as being something that someone could break your security with, but I would encourage you to keep your screens clean.
For many reasons, not just security, but for hygiene reasons. If you
Certainly.
Think about it, your phone is probably the single collector of every germ you ever pick up if you use it regularly. So,
very true.
Good advice. This a secondary tip. This is a tip from my son, because this is what they use in the Apple Store, is Bausch & Lomb Cleanse. That's a spray bottle, cleaning spray, they call it. I forget how much this was, but I got it in the Apple Store. You can probably get it cheaper on Amazon. But you get this, and then you get a cleaning cloth.
Yeah, got one right here.
No, you use the same? Yep.
Microfiber, yep. That's
works
nice.
Well.
Monster cloth I have.
Okay.
All right, I also have a pick, so I'm going to just jump right
in. Charge ahead.
Share my screen, and this is a quick pick for the Easter season. For those of you that are into 8-bit music, this is the 8-bit hymnal, the third version, and I've actually shared this on the show before, but week, an Easter version of the 8-bit hymnal was released. So if you like clunky video game music, then you will enjoy listening to hymns in that format. It's available on the website NoiseTrade, which is free for download. You can leave a tip for the artist who created it if you so desire. By someone, and his name's not jumping out at me right now, and I probably should have had that in front of me. Tyler Larson is his name. So Tyler has created 2 others. There's just an 8-bit hymnal, and then there's a Christmas version that you can get as well. All 3 free downloads from NoiseTrade. So check out the link in the show notes.
Very nice. My pick of the week was actually an announcement back March 27th, quite an exciting announcement for some people, and that was the fact that Microsoft was releasing Office for iPad. There had been kind of ways around this, and then some third-party vendors who had put together solutions where you could view your Word, your Excel, your PowerPoint documents on an iPad, but nothing really elegant and nothing nearly as nice as what Microsoft is now offering with their Office for iPad. They did an exceedingly good job at kind of keeping in mind that this is a touch-based interface, smaller screen, so they made the touch targets nice size and intuitive. They used natural scrolling, you know, things that, you know, they assumed that you'd be using your fingers to interact with your documents. So they did a nice job with this. The application is free in the App Store, in the iOS iTunes Store. So you can download that now. Without an Office 365 account, really the only thing you can do is view documents. There are some ways around that, but essentially that's what you're kind of limited to. It works seamlessly with OneDrive. So if you have an Office 365 account, which is actually a very good deal if you want to stay in the Microsoft ecosystem, so to speak, probably the price of a grande coffee at Starbucks per month is what it will cost you to get an Office 365 account. But then you really kind of have a seamless experience if you work with Office documents. So there is a trial that you can download and see how it works, and just a nicely done application. So if you are on iOS, you don't have to wait any longer. Office is on the iPad.
Excellent. Thanks for sharing that.
Do you have it
that.
On your iPad yet, Sally?
I don't. I'm behind the curve there, so I guess I'll be downloaded that.
Five users, so.
Yeah. Got to get with the program.
All right. Let's move along quickly here. Just a reminder, a couple reminders. Final Web Training, we've talked about it in the past. If you are a Final Web webmaster, this would be great for you to get on your radar. Just go to bit.ly/FWTrainingInfo to read all about our training that's coming up July 29th through August 1st. We have all kinds of opportunities for you. Actually, let me turn my screen sharing off. All kinds of opportunities for you to take advantage of that. 4 days of training, $49 a day, $129 for three. We have 1 day specifically set aside for just teachers. And then we have a beginner, intermediate, and advanced. And it's going to all take place at the Center for Mission and Ministry right here in lovely Waukesha, Wisconsin. Sally, you want to talk about the KML stuff?
Yeah, we have another event that's coming up in June. And, you know, I was just going to verify. I wrote that date down. I believe the date is June 3rd. I'm just looking at my calendar real quick. That is correct. It's June 3rd. And the event is actually Ed Kettle, and it's a teacher in service kind of day. So the idea is that there will be it'll be after school's out. Teachers are relaxed. They're thinking about the next school year, making plans for their technology for the next school year. So it's going to be very tech focused. And Martin and I are both going to be in attendance that day. Martin, you're going to be presenting on Google Slides, and I'm going to tackle Google Forms. We also are planning to do our podcast live from the Tech and Teach event at Kettle on June 3rd. So please come out and join us. More information is going to be made available in the coming weeks from the planning committee, and we look forward to seeing you there.
I think they're opening up to everybody, aren't they?
That's correct.
Just be in the Federation there. So it'd be up in Jackson, Wisconsin, about half hour north of Milwaukee. Sally, let's rip through our community feedback here.
I'm ready to rip through community feedback, but I need to share my screen one more time. So first up in terms of community feedback is a website that I tagged called SumDog, S-U-M-D-O-G, and this is actually a logged-in view. You create an avatar, and you can play games that are math or reading or writing oriented, and some of it is free, some of it is pay for games, but it seems to... they seem to have done a really great job with it. You have a teacher account where you can manage your student accounts, that kind of thing.
What's the, is there an age range?
I think it's all elementary, so yeah, it can start from kindergarten on up, and they have simple
games.
It looks
very graphical, so something that might be appealing. So, yeah, it's all computer-based.
Right.
Or PC-based, not an app or something.
Correct.
Okay.
Next up is a site called donorschoose.org. I read an article about Google gifting 600 Bay Area teachers with classroom wish list from this website, Donor's Choice. So the concept is that teachers kind of promote ideas that they have for their classrooms, and donors can come and sponsor them. You can find teachers in your area to sponsor, that kind of thing.
Donorschoice.org. You know, mostly kind of community things. There's things that would be appealing for somebody to say, hey, I'll help you do that project, that kind of thing.
Right. It just depends on what the teacher is wanting to do. You know, maybe they want to do some kind of special art project or science event or whatever.
Go on a field trip or whatever.
It's kind of a Kickstarter kind of feel. Put it out there and get crowdfunding, basically.
Okay.
But school-centric.
I suppose you could just advertise it just to your parents, even.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
Good idea.
All right. Next up is a website called InternetEssentials.com. This was sent to us from Aaron Spike, who's been on Wells Tech before, a friend of the show, and he says, I don't get out much, so I wasn't aware of this Comcast program, which allows people who qualify for the National School Lunch Program to get low-cost internet service. So this is basically bringing the internet to schools, to children, students, in low-income families, those that would qualify for the reduced-price lunch or free lunch programs. It's Internet Essentials, and it's from Comcast.
So you'd have to be in a Comcast service area, I'm guessing?
I believe so.
And does it say the price there? Is it $9.95 a month?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. That's not bad.
Right, right.
Okay.
All right. We heard from a listener we hadn't heard from before, R.C. Jensen, who wrote to us to share an article called How the Internet is Taking Away America's Religion, and interesting correlations drawn from internet use and the number of people that don't attend church or don't proclaim a particular affiliation with a church. Maybe a bit of a stretch, not... you know, there could be other factors in there, but I think they make a really good case for the fact that there's definitely been a decline in affiliation with church bodies in the same time period as the growth of the internet. So, interesting read. RC included some notes to us about how, you know, he can see universities kind of and places of higher learning kind of moving away from religious beliefs and, you know, that kind of thing. So, it's challenging times that we're in to spread the gospel.
That would be a very interesting conversation to have about some of the factors that are involved in it. And I would think that a part of the conversation would be just the free and rapid flow of information and the diversity of opinion and maybe even the, you know, the nature of communication these days, how easy it is to
self-publish.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Very true. All right, from our friend Cindy Krieger, she wrote to us with an article from WebJunction, which is specifically library-centric, educational libraries. This was a really well-done article about adding iPads to a children's library. And the librarian who wrote it, Rapid City, I would assume maybe South Dakota, talks through all the logistics, you know, how she decided on which stands to use and what kind of flexibility to have with them, charging cables, doing the whole accounts and setting up restrictions and things like that. It's very well done and very detailed. And then she kind of analyzes, you know, the effects of it, the fact that the iPads are in use all the time in their library by the children in the children's area. So if you're looking for some feedback on an iPad program, this would be a great article to read.
I like the title.
Yeah, I fought the iPads and I won. How about that? And then finally, just had some contact with Professor Becky Cox. She's a physical education professor at Martin Luther College, and she had just recently attended a professional development event and, in particular, a technology presentation. So she shared a link to the presentation. I always like to look through these kind of things just to see if there's something new, you know, that someone's demoing. This particular presenter from the University of Wisconsin in Stevens Point actually put together a couple of video tutorials that walk people through the tools that she was presenting on. And one in particular that she linked to had to do with the use of QR codes in physical education. And there's some really fun, cool examples of using QR codes to enhance PE and just movement, more movement in our lives and things like that. So check out the article if you do any PE work or if you like QR codes and want to see some creative uses of them. And thanks, Becky, for sharing that.
Cool.
That's what I have for community feedback, Martin.
If you, too, would like to contribute to our community feedback section, we'd love to have you. Go to wellstech.wells.net. Send us an email, wellstech@wells.net, or any of the social networks. We're there. Love to see those Pinterest posts, pins, whatever they're called, Facebook, Twitter, Digo. All those are available to you, so no excuse. You can't tell us. You can't get your information to us. Sally, what are we going to do next week?
Well, next week you have laid down the challenge, and I think we're going to do a do-it-yourself project. I believe the idea is that we're going to build stands for our phones.
Yes.
So an ability to stand the phone up and be able to have it display for you in a standing mode. I don't have one of those. I have a stand for my iPad, and it was bought at the store, and it works just fine. So now I don't get to buy.
That is off limits. You cannot be bought from a store,
right,
shrink wrapped in any way, or have any kind of claim on it that it says it does this. It has to be kind of a, yeah, it's got to be a hack, a life hack.
And have you started on yours? Do you have ideas?
Nope.
Okay, good. Neither
no,
do
we
I.
We haven't said go yet. So.
Okay, good deal.
But that'll be next week. And we also have an interview.
Fortunately, we have an interview to
in case that whole DIY thing crashes and burns, yes.
Yeah.
It's good.
We're looking forward to talking to our friend Laura Harstad, who is the International Volunteer Coordinator and Project Developer for Kingdom Workers. Laura has an exciting job, works with mission volunteers and missionaries to coordinate their service in the mission field. And we want to learn about that from Laura next week.
Yeah, excited to have Laura. I met Laura, I don't know if it was for the first time, but definitely enjoyed time spent with her in Las Vegas at our outreach conference, and just love her passion and enthusiasm. She's
definitely
a perfect fit for the role she's got there, Kingdom Workers. So.
Yep. And you're a perfect fit for the role of Grandpa, so that's my new moniker for you, Grandpa Martin.
Gramps. Yeah.
Gramps. I like that.
All right. Your time will come.
No. Enjoy the baby.
Regardless
time
of what your kids say, they'll all make fine parents. Make a fine grandma. Or however you say it in the South.
Nana, actually.
Grammy, nanny, yeah, Nana. All right. We're well past where we should have closed the show. Thank you all for joining us. And if you have some time next week, Tuesday, 4 o'clock, that's when we gather our little group together and talk about technology and ministry. Just go to Wells Tech, what is it, wellstechlive.wells.net, and you will be able to find where we hang out Tuesday afternoons. So take care, blessings, and talk to you next week.